you could see the real right view on the top of Meditation Mountain. So she was happy, but she could also appreciate the stillness on top of Meditation Mountain. And Metta the dog, she was so happy loving the whole universe from on top of Meditation Mountain, just boundless, infinite, unbounded loving kindness for the whole universe on top of Meditation Mountain. Anapanasati was nowhere to be found. She disappeared. Because on top of Meditation Mountain, your breath vanishes. And kindness and love and bliss are just so incredibly strong. And you're so still. And so much wisdom. Because all those three coexist on the top of Meditation Mountain. It's not just Samatha Vipassana. I don't know why people forget Metta as well. Samatha Vipassana and Metta come together on the top of Meditation Mountain. They're the same. Ajahn Chah, his simile. Now you see the front of my hand, now you see the back. Now you see the front, now you see the back. When you see the back of the hand, the front is still there. When you see the front, the back is still there. That's Samatha Vipassana. They can't be separated. So said Ajahn Chah. Buddha told us to let the mind peace because it's strong. Until enlightenment. Let the mind be because it's strong. Until enlightenment. We should cherish our life to learn disciples, Sangha. Then we can free from painful life reincarnation. I'm confused. How should I face my current life meaningful and happy if current life is a challenge and future is the future destination? If your life is a challenge for you, great. Because the challenge just makes you more diligent in your practice. Sometimes that when life is almost intolerable, you don't have much choice except to let go. Sometimes when life is going very sweetly for you and everything is very easy, then it's not real incentive to meditate and let go. Remember that some of the times the way I learned how to get past my body was thankfully to the mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes, they were biting me so much. If my mind wandered off to the body, I'd feel this terrible irritation. So when I let go of the mosquito, or let go of the body, go inside the mind, you couldn't feel the mosquitoes anymore. Or the time when I had scrub typhus fever, and that was very challenging for me. I was in this was 1975, I believe, and that no one thought that scrub typhus was in that area because all the locals were immune. You need sort of quite low to come into the picture, and then they had no immunity, so we got scrub typhus and no one knew what it was. So we put in the monk's ward of Ubon Hospital. That was a third world country. And this was a monk's ward, which was the worst of the worst, because monks were supposed to be tough. So, the first night in the monk's ward of Ubon Hospital in 1975, the nurse at 6 p.m. disappeared. 7 p.m. still hadn't got the replacement nurse. I knew enough Thai, I asked the monk in the next bed, should we let somebody know the night nurse hasn't turned up? And he told me, what do you mean night nurse? There is no night nurse. For 12 hours, there was no nurse at all, no emergency buttons. If something went wrong and you had a complication, bad luck, bad karma. And that was not the sort of hospital I was used to. And then it got even worse. Because they didn't know what I had, they decided to give me a cocktail of antibiotics injected into my bum twice a day by this nurse. And you think that maybe Thai women are very petite, not in the northeast. This particular nurse, no exaggeration, she was built like a water buffalo. She had to be, because she never injected you. She stabbed you. And it was bang. Those were those times of recycled needles. Remember those old needles? They had to put them and steam them first of all to try and get rid of any antibiotics. Not the one-use high-tech needles. They had to sort of sharpen them up, I reckon, because they were so dull. You couldn't sort of inject them. You had to stab them. And even though I had a lot of loving kindness, not for that nurse, about 3 or 4 weeks, twice a day, it's like going to the principal's office. And so, what did you do? And even Ajahn Chah, when Ajahn Chah came, that was the story when he came to see me. I was only a young monk, and this great teacher came into the monk's ward, and I thought, wow, marvelous, at last, someone who cares about me. He came up, he only was there for about 10 seconds. He looked at me, and I was expecting some nice care and kindness. And how are you? Anything you need? Is there anything we can do for you? No, not Ajahn Chah. He said, Brahma Wang said, you'll either get better or you'll die. And he turned around and left. And the worst thing was, he was right. You know, you can't argue with that Dhamma. You'll either get better or you'll die. Either way, you don't have to endure the pain forever. But that's not what I wanted. But anyway, that one day, just, you know, having a fever about 3 or 4 weeks, so you had absolutely no energy. I mean, I've never felt as close to dying with no energy as that. And just lying in your bed, not knowing what to do, and thinking, my monk should meditate. So I closed my eyes and just watched my breath. It was beautiful. You went inside. So the ache, the heaviness, the pain, the tiredness of your body just transcended. You had a wonderful time. Maybe those blissful states really stood out because of what was there before, the ache and pain of a fever. And just, afterwards, I don't know how long, an hour, 2 hours or something, just so blissful, so peaceful. One of the things which I looked at afterwards, which changed some of my teachings, my body. Legs were all over the place. You know, just hands here, hands there. My posture, when you're in bed with a fever, I've never seen any posture like that described in the book of meditation. But nevertheless, it worked. So your body knows how it's supposed to be positioned. But if I didn't have that fever, I wouldn't have actually gone that deep in meditation. Because I had to. So sometimes the difficulties in life, the challenges of life, are opportunities to do something different, to go deeper, to find another source of power. So if you do have challenges in life, don't waste them. So, and you're not enlightened, but you're just learning just what enlightenment is. Thank you for answering. I believe in one truth and many paths. What are your thoughts about being non-religious? Why do we need, what is the purpose of religious acts? Is it important? What are your advice for people who believe all religions are okay? What about those who believe in none? Is being a Buddhist important for practice to seek peace and happiness? Why? So, if you want a religion, fine. That's what I say that over in Australia when people ask, is Buddhism a religion? What do we answer? Yes, for tax purposes anyway. But, it's a non-theistic religion, so why do we need to put labels onto things and put things into boxes? Because when we have labels and boxes, we say, my religion is better than yours, this is the fast way, yours is the slow way, mine is the high way, yours is the low way. That sort of stuff. That's what really upsets me. That whatever your path is, you'll know it's a good path by just how peaceful it makes you, how much harmony it engenders. Not just the wisdom so you can write books and become a professor, but the wisdom which is tested in the challenges in life, and you pull through the practical wisdom of life. And in fact, it's a common theme in life that many people get fed up with religion. They promise a lot, deliver very little. And then sometimes they say, oh, just when you become enlightened or when you die, then you know what's right and what's wrong. But it's a bit late then, isn't it? So instead, that we always mention that Emperor's Three Questions story. An emperor who had it up to here with religion, but had the power and authority to make his own religion. So he realized there's only three things in life you need to know the answer for. When is the most important time? Who's the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? You know that I mentioned that during for a meditation method. When is the most important time? Now. Who's the most important person? Is it the Buddha or the Jesus or the Bodhisattva or Ajahnpa? Or is it, who's the most important person? The one right in front of you. Whoever that happens to be. What's the most important thing to do? Is to care. There was a story written by Leo Tolstoy again. What a powerful teaching that is. Simple. Do you need to be a Buddhist or a Christian or an atheist to hold that? That's practical, that works. As I say, when I bow to the Buddha, I don't bow to an image. What it represents, keep it practical, keep it useful. And then you find a deep truth in your own heart. You know it's good because it doesn't cause problems between people. We don't fight for market share of the religious market. We just share. How are we going for time? I've got 8:14. Are you okay carrying on? Okay. Is fully focused on, say, I'm an atheist as well. You know, you want to be an atheist, fine. Sometimes is Buddhism an atheist religion? Does Buddhism believe in a creator God? Does Buddhism believe in God? What is Buddhist idea of God? So, this is where we innovate. If we say that Buddhism doesn't believe in God, other people really believe in God, we create a war. Arguments, differences. So how can we use wisdom to transcend the important people's reverence for a God? And this was the story of being challenged by this quite a well-known Australian theologian, Frank Brennan. He challenged me one day, now with respect, he said, what is the Buddha's view of God? And I was sitting next to a friend, Abbot Placid, who was the abbot of a Benedictine monastery. I deliberately cultivated friendships, not with people who agreed with me, but with people who challenged me. So I recalled many times in our conversations, friendly conversations. Now he was he had a good sense of humour too, so I remember teasing him once, walking through his old monastery. You know, it's one of the oldest buildings in Western Australia. And I said, are there any ghosts in your monastery? He said, no, I'm a Catholic, we don't believe in ghosts. And I said, what about the Holy Ghost? Ha ha ha, got you. Bloody teasing him. So he laughed, he does the same to me. So anyway, this occasion that he often used to tell me one of his core beliefs as a Catholic, as a Christian, was that everyone is searching for God. Now, don't rebel against that or have any resistance to that. I said, I'm going to respect that statement. So, because I respect the man who said it, he's a friend. So, if if everyone is searching for God, what are you searching for? As an atheist, as a Buddhist, as a scientist, what are you searching for in your life? And then we get these wonderful answers. You search for respect. People actually respect you, respect your boundaries, respect who you are, respect your customs, respect your space. That you search for the great joy to be loved. To be loved and accepted. The door of my heart is totally open. And someone says that to you. And you can give that same love to somebody else. You search for truth, for peace. Sometimes we search for the ability to find our own way in this world. To have rest, to search for beauty, whatever, fulfillment. You can add many other things. So what do you search for in life? What would you, why are you working? Search for meaning. Search for the wonderful thing to have someone say thank you because what you did or how you helped me was such an amazing, amazing experience. They really say thank you. To search for moments like that. And so, when I added all those up together and said, as a Buddhist or as an atheist, this is what people search for, what everyone searches for. So if my friend said everyone searches for God, and this is what Buddhist atheists search for, that must be what God means to a Buddhist. Truth, respect, peace, giving love, receiving love, caring, meaning, truth, peace. You can add to that list. But it's something which everyone can share. So instead of having an idea which creates walls and boundaries and arguments, it's something which can unite us, which we have in common. So remember, Frank Brennan is a very, you know, very strong intellectual, highly respected. He said, wow, that was really unexpected. Yeah, that's a great answer. So I was very happy that, you know, he approved of it. And why not? Because that's an atheist idea of what people search for, what you want in life. Search for especially respect. There's too many people we just feel we're taken for granted. Though we just, other people just use us for whatever they want to use us for. And we're not really respected. So giving a person respect and kindness and peace, and those are things which I think we can agree upon is what people search for. So call that God, if you wish. And I'll put my hand up. I believe in that. Do you believe in that? Hopefully. So that's something more tangible. After death, consciousness gets separated from the body. What happens to this consciousness? It's a flow of consciousness, a stream of consciousness that goes to where you want it to go. According to your craving and your karma. In other words, if you want to come and visit me in Perth, Western Australia, there's two requirements. One is you got to have the funds and the passport and the visa. And the other one is you have to want to go there. You have the karmic causes and you also have the will to go there. So that's, you know, if you want to go any place of rebirth, you have to want to go there and have the karmic causes to go there. That's where your consciousness goes, according to karma, according to craving. But it can also come back here when the stream of consciousness says a ghost. It's time for a ghost story. You want a ghost story? Ah, that's just too much. Well, you've got to get the people outside to have the lights. And so, ghost stories. They were I don't know why people are afraid of ghost stories. Ghosts are really beautiful and helpful. There's so many, but this one person, he was another Quilo, and living in Perth. Quilo means no English man. For those of you who don't know, who don't speak Cantonese, I know what it means also. So I'm not kidding. That's a word for an Englishman. But anyway, he was middle of the night in the bedroom by himself, fast asleep. He woke up. He felt something strange was happening. Middle of the night, so he turned on his bedside lamp. At the end of his bed was his mum. His mother lived in Essex, in England. This was in Perth, the same suburb, Nollamara, as our city centre temple. Mother standing at the end of the bed. She lived in England. This was in Australia. He knew straight away that this was a ghost, and his mother had died. And it wasn't just a wispy image. It was clear. The light was on, and it remained for 4 or 5 minutes. A long time. And there he was, just propped up in bed, looking at his mother. His mother was smiling at him. And he was just basking in his mother's love for the last time. He said it was one of the most beautiful experiences. Not at all afraid, but just the final parting, saying goodbye of a mother to her son. And for 5 or 6 minutes, just smiling at each other, as only like a mother can smile to their children. It was one of the most gorgeous moments. And then she just faded, disappeared. Being an English man, he got out of bed and made himself a cup of tea. And he was drinking his tea when the telephone rang. "Peter, I got some bad news," said his sister, straight from the hospital. "Yeah, I know, Mum's dead." And the way he said it shocked his sister. "What do you mean? How do you know? Why aren't you upset?" And when he told what had happened, that his mother had visited him, it's not at all any grief, so peaceful. He'd been so blessed to have had the final visit from his mum. What a blessing that was. And I think if any of your parents die, they're overseas or you're not there with them, what a wonderful thing that would be to see them one last time. Smiling at you, expressing their love before they went on the next part of their journey. It's a beautiful story. Real, true ghost story. Not scary, but I think many say, "I wish I had that experience." One last time, not to say things, but just to smile and express one another's love. Will we become more pure spiritually if we become celibate? Only if you feel comfortable being celibate. If a person is celibate and it's a tough journey for them, then it doesn't work. You become too stressed out. And sometimes people enjoy being celibate. You know, you get used to it, it's very peaceful. And I've always mentioned before in my book why I became celibate. I was an active heterosexual. I had a good girlfriend. And enjoying all the... Sometimes people get upset when I say this, having good sex with my girlfriend. And then just leaving her in Gloucester to go to a meditation retreat. And I never expected what would happen, getting into this incredibly deep meditation. And the bliss, the sheer joy of it, the pleasure of it, was better than sex. Lasted longer and was deeper. And that blew me away. How can that happen? You know, my reaction was, why hasn't anyone told me about this before? to me, I thought, you know, the highest pleasure was, you know, sort of sex. Or later on, there was had a heroin addict who was staying at our monastery, trying to sort of cold turkey and just give up the habit. And I taught him some meditation. I don't know how he managed to do this, but he slipped into a deep meditation. He came running out to me and said, yeah, I could sort of understand that, you know, the bliss of meditation is better than sex, but I never thought I'd say it was better than heroin. And the way he said it, you know, with honesty, with frankness, I thought, wow, because I've never taken heroin. But he said that, you know, that's why it's addictive to people. Just the bliss you can't get anywhere else, but you found another way, you know, from deep meditation. And that's actually stunning to say that. But that's what happens, and we really are just into immense pleasures. And why? And for anyone who says, oh, you get attached to those pleasures, yes, you will. And the Buddha said, anyone who gets attached to the pleasures of meditation is either going to become a stream winner, a once returner, non-returner, or fully enlightened. That's the only four options for you, by being attached to the pleasures of deep meditation. It's not a bad deal, is it? So anyway, how to overcome sleepiness and pain during meditation. If you're meditating, you feel sleepy, then don't fight it. This is the cause and effect there. Sleepy in the jungles of Thailand for many years, went down to Bangkok to do some visas, stayed in Wat Pho Won. It was a wealthy monastery, a royal monastery. They had a new building where we stayed, had one room, was an air-conditioned room. We used to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, so no one else was using that room at that time of the day, 3 o'clock in the morning before alms round. So we managed to borrow the key, and we'd meditate in there from 3 to maybe 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. In the air-conditioned room, because as Westerners were meditating in there, no sloth and torpor, no sleepiness. The temperature was just right for Westerners. We didn't feel sleepy. From that time on, I realized there's external causes make you sleepy. You haven't slept enough. You're catching up on your sleep, your tiredness. You're bored with Ajahn Brahm's talks. Although I don't know. But there's external causes. You look at those simple answers and you become bright. Catch up on your sleep. It's just the right temperature. You have some good food. Yeah, body's fit and healthy. Then sleepiness doesn't come. In brief, it's not your fault. Don't blame yourself. It's cause and effect. So if you're sleepy, go to bed. That's the best antidote for sleepiness. If it's painful, stretch your legs. People just want, no, come on, Ajahn Brahm. Can you give us something more spiritual, more psychic, more deep? You know, sometimes people just want the deep teachings and they just don't see the obvious answers. How to react finding, how to act finding meaning and uncertainty for the workplace. It's if it's in the workplace, you don't know just how things are going in the future, but in the workplace you can upgrade your skill set so it's able to be used no matter what happens in our workplace. We don't think that life is always going to go in the same lazy, comfortable way in the future. So when you have a skill set, number one, you have personal skills, so you get on with other people, you make your contacts with other people, and you know, you learn from other people, and you find that one of the great skill sets is being open to change. And little things like that, you find confidence in your own abilities, ability to learn, see things from a different way. Those are skill sets which you will always find it useful somewhere in the workplace. Even these days, when people said, oh, meditating some time ago, a few years ago, said I won't put that down in my CV because that would mean that you know, I'm weird and they won't want to employ me. But of course you all know now that if you're a meditator, they realize you can handle stress. So they like to employ you. So upgrade your skill set by learning more meditation. Last question. If I'm hurt by someone, is it a must that I have to learn how to forgive him? What about her? Can I forgive myself for not forgiving him? Of course, you don't have to. The pressure, the force, compulsion just makes matters worse. To love that monster, allow the monster of anger or not being able to forgive, allow that to come into your heart, because if you're kind to the monster, the love of the monster gets smaller and smaller, softer and softer. This is not a must. It's just, why not? And after a while, forgiving a person, just, why not? It's their karma. So you don't have to be the executioner and the punisher. And sometimes if you give someone some forgiveness, how many of you have done a terrible thing in your life? Would you like to be forgiven, given another chance? I would, if I've done something. I'd like to be forgiven if I misjudge the situation. So if you want to be forgiven, how about practicing forgiveness on others? And they don't take advantage. If you do it in the right way, they don't take advantage of you. Sometimes the forgiveness is so amazing, so rare. What was that in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa? That's where Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu rightly got the Nobel Peace Prize for that one. And if you ever read some of the transcripts, it's so amazing. In one case, a white South African police officer was describing in detail how he tortured and killed a black African activist from the ANC. It was the ANC, the African National Congress. And extrajudicial torture and killing. And the widow was listening. The woman who had chosen that man to be her partner, the mother of his children, all she knew was her husband had disappeared in the middle of the night. No record of what happened to him. She was hearing for the first time how this white African police officer had tortured and killed him. The police officer was shaking because the idea was, if you were honest and, you know, let people know what had happened, you get amnesty. So what happened after the testimony was finished? The woman just jumped over the security, managed to evade the officers who were there to protect the police officer from retribution and payback. She reached that police officer. He was just stunned and frozen. She could have killed him, but instead she put her arms around him and hugged him and said, I forgive you. And when I heard that, I thought, if a woman can forgive the man who murdered her husband, which she obviously still loved and cared for, she could forgive that person who just described in detail how he had extrajudicially tortured and killed this guy. If she could forgive, then surely there's hardly any act or crime which a person cannot forgive. That raised the bar to such a high level. People say, no, you can't forgive this, it's too bad. don't know how much worse it can get. But she managed to forgive. She set a standard which made forgiveness possible. So, please forgive me for going over time 6 minutes. So hopefully you I answered those questions appropriately. If I didn't, maybe you can try again next time. So the box is open. Okay, is that okay? Okay, so sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. But for goodness sake, don't feel guilty if you can't forgive. So people are so complicated. Oh, I can't forgive, so you feel even more guilty. So forgive yourself not being able to forgive. Don't feel guilty about being guilty. It's just, we just add to it. It's called double suffering, double dukkha. Anyway, have a wonderful evening. If you wish to carry on meditating, please. The place is open till... Della? 10:30! Wow! So 9:30. 9:30. 10:30. The night is still young. Okay. Have a good evening. I like the saying...